Hi. This episode will tell the story of the Boxgrove Man, the oldest skeleton ever discovered in Britain. This chewed leg bone and two badly cared for teeth, found in a chalk and gravel quarry in Suffolk, date back around 500,000 years ago to a period called the Lower Paleolithic, a time before modern humans. Today we discuss Britain at the height of the Ice Age and how humans used that landscape. We're going to talk about human evolution, the lifestyles of pre-modern humans, and how they adapted to the frosty climate of Ice Age Europe. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. Britain is defined by the sea. Throughout the island story, the ocean has in turn separated from and then connected the island to the rest of the world. Never has Britain's relationship with the oceans been as dramatic as it was during the last glut of ice ages. We call that age of glaciers the Pleistocene. Or if you're my fiancé, the Plasticine. During this period, there were regular glaciations, when glaciers covered the British Isles in thick ice, sometimes as far south as the Isles of Scilly. These rivers of ice would have pushed all life out of Britain. During this time, Britain didn't exist. It was subsumed in ice. Nothing lived, nothing moved, except the crunching creak of the glacier's advance. However, in between these glaciations were periods called interglacials. You know about interglacials. You live in one. During these periods, which are often shorter than the glaciations, the climate warms and the glaciers retreat. The first things to return as the glaciers crumble backwards are grasses and wildflowers. It takes a long time for glaciers to melt, especially without humans or volcanoes pouring greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Even when Britain began to become grassy, green and pleasant again, much of the world was still ice, which the glaciers gave up unwillingly. It wasn't just Britain that was distorted and transformed by the glaciers. They sucked up the oceans and turned a vast swathe of land from Ireland and Spain all the way to Canada and the USA into a never-ending steppe or plain. Into these lands came beasts like muskox, reindeer, and woolly mammoths. In the wake of all these animals come humans. We're warm world creatures made adaptable by intelligence. We're not much good in the cold. But if there are resources for us to exploit, we can survive. These giant beasts, walking masses of fur, fat, bones, and proteins, were excellent resources. However, 500 years ago, the humans chasing bison and mammoth are not us. They're not Homo sapiens. They are something, somewhat, different. There's been a lot of talk so far of ice and frigid tundras. How about we turn briefly to Africa, where humans first came from? There's another episode, perhaps an entire series, looking only at human evolution. What you're about to hear then isn't a detailed discussion on how we became Homo sapiens. However, I want to take you back, briefly, to the first definite, no questions asked about human, Homo erectus. It's all right. I laugh at the name too. This ape, and ones before it, evolving in the hot, dry African savanna, developed some adaptations suited to that environment. Some apes started walking upright on two legs, making them taller and better at running long distances. Because their pelvises then got narrower, humans also became terrible at giving birth to children. Our eye size increased and sense of smell got worse. Apes' brains got bigger on a feast of marrow and scavenged meat. The muscles in our jaw increased and we got better at making sounds, leading to a larger range of communications and even language. That meant we could talk to each other, and talking is a much more effective way of forming social bonds than simply picking bugs off each other like other apes do. Now that led to deeper social connections beginning to form, at some point based on the speech we were developing. Our hands changed shape. Now, All apes have grasping hands with the thumb and little finger opposite each other. But our ancestors' hands got more nimble, allowing early humans to close the gap between their thumb and little finger. These opposable thumbs and nimble fingers allowed for greater control and tool use. Apes, like Homo erectus, lost their body hair and developed the ability to sweat. This allowed long-legged humans to cover very great distances without getting exhausted. The hominins that began leaving Africa around 1.2 million years ago were significantly different from previous apes. They were sweaty, tall, and hairless, able to cover vast distances without tiring. They were much smarter and more sociable. They communicated with each other and, due to their terrible for childbirth pelvises, had tight-knit communities who shared the raising of children. Finally, they used their big brains and opposable thumbs to develop tools to hunt and butcher prey, and also to prepare food. Wait. Before we go any further, I think I snuck in a technical term without providing an explanation. What on earth is a hominin? Hominin technically is the tribe of great apes, including the species with Homo before the name, such as us, Homo sapiens, but also Homo erectus, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo habilis, etc., etc. It also includes animals like chimpanzees and an extinct group of animals called Australopithecus, which, for this episode, can be explained as chimpanzees that walked on two legs. However, in my experience, archaeologists and anthropologists use the term hominin to speak of the group with Homo before the name. So essentially, hominin means humans, but not us. These hominins, they left Africa, but we don't really know why. When they left their homeland, they didn't stay the same for very long. As we change the world changes us. As the genus began to populate Syria and Spain, Turkey and Italy, they began to transform. They grew hairier and they grew larger, not just in body mass, but in brain size too. Their tools became more beautiful, more thought out. In Europe, they turned into a species called Homo antecessor, or literally, ancestral human. That species then evolved into Homo heidelbergensis, and it is that hominin, that variant on the human theme, that we're going to be discussing today. If Homo erectus, get your minds out of the gutter, means upright human, and if Homo antecessor means ancestral human, what does Homo heidelbergensis mean? Well, it's a depressingly unimaginative name. The very first fossil of this species was found near to the university town of Heidelberg in southwest Germany. Since Heidelberg is a nice place, they decided to name this new species after the town. Why are they important to us? Well, in many ways, because they're people. Not people in some profound, academic way, but people in the way that you and I think of people. These humans could probably speak. They were usually right-handed, and Homo heidelbergensis evolved into two species. European heidelbergensis evolved into Homo neanderthalensis, the Neanderthals, and modern Europeans are about 3% Neanderthal. In Africa, though, Homo heidelbergensis also evolved into another human species, a special sort of species, a species we call Homo sapiens. Us. You. Me. When we look at the skeletons of Homo heidelbergensis, we are, in a way, looking at our very early grandparents. Their family. Half a million years ago, the British winds were bitter. This was the very edge of human survival. For millennia, no human dare cross into Britain. It was too cold, too dark, too tough. Britain was closer in climate to modern-day northern Scandinavia. Adapting to weather like that requires more than warm clothes and snowshoes. In subarctic climates, the animals are different. Reindeer in the far north change with the weather. Their blood vessels knot themselves closer to each other, so the blood is kept further from the skin and stays warmer. The pads on the hooves shrink, revealing the bare hoof, giving them better purchase on the icy ground. And their eyes. Their eyes change with the seasons, from a deep summer gold to a dark winter blue. Humans evolved too. Homo heidelbergensis had shorter, thicker legs. Their bodies were also broader than previous human species. Being bigger makes you warmer, helps you keep the heat in. However, these are variations on a generalist theme, not specific adaptations to a particular climate. Despite Homo heidelbergensis' adaptations, this climate was still really too tough for humans. It's only when the glaciers left for good that humans were able to make it permanently in Britain. This reminds us of the limits of Homo heidelbergensis. It reminds us of what this species isn't. They're not Homo sapiens. Whilst they're probably making clothing of some sort, we don't have the tiny, fragile needles and awls that we do when Homo sapiens enter Europe. We have no evidence that Homo heidelbergensis is building permanent, quality shelters. This species of human, like every other species bar Homo sapiens, tread lightly on the earth. It wasn't changing its environment. Instead, it lived in and was shaped by its world. It wandered the landscape by the routes set by nature. It rested when nature allowed it to rest. Now, no doubt that means that Homo heidelbergensis lived in and used a variety of landscapes. We've got evidence for them in the hills of southwest England, where we find hand axes in dolines, which are sinkholes or eroded hollows of chalk. And that makes sense. Uphill sites like the hills are drier, have less trees, and allow you to see where you're going better. Humans tend to gravitate towards ridgetops or riverways to aid them in navigation. But think about the places to live, the nicest places to visit. They're usually places on the edges of lakes, rivers, or oceans. Humans really love being near water. Archaeologists like boggy wet sites for other reasons too. They're really good at preserving material, especially organic material like wood, nuts, pollen, and, as at Boxgrove, bones. They're often very useful in modern times too. Not because these sites are boggy, but because they used to be so. Whereas upland sites are constantly exposed to eroding forces like wind and rain, lowland sites are rapidly and continuously covered in material. More modern humans sometimes decide that that material, which has filled the site in, is useful to them, and so they'll dig the materials up. Now, this gives archaeologists free excavations, so they can poke around and see what's happening. Many, many sites have been discovered by modern industrialization. Our site today, Boxgrove, is one of these lowland sites revealed by industry. We discovered Boxgrove because in the last 500,000 years, it's filled with chalk and gravel. Today, the site is a flat-bottomed hollow of scrubland, which is the uninspiring and uninteresting remains of a chalk and gravel quarry. However, in very ancient times, the site was quite different. Today, near Boxgrove, the South Downs are gentle rolling hills, home to sheep, pubs, and little else. During the times of Homo heidelbergensis, 500,000 years ago, our site would have sat a little way away from sheer chalk cliffs caused by falling sea levels. These cliffs would regularly crumble and shear material into a jagged pile of chalk and flint below them. The excavators have called Boxgrove a Fairweather Eden, a title I have shamelessly stolen for the title of this episode. When the glaciers allowed, it was an ideal location, and over the millennia of intermittent visits to Britain by heidelbergensis, they often stopped off at Boxgrove. We have evidence for humans visiting Boxgrove on at least three separate occasions. During the first of Homo heidelbergensis visits, Boxgrove was little more than a stony beach. There, Homo heidelbergensis walked along the coastline before turning up a river valley to access the richer inlands. Archaeologists call this the elephant bed because Britain at the time was so chock full of mammoths that many of their fossils are found in this strata. As the sea began to retreat, it created a lagoon, muddy ground interspersed with pools of water, occasionally flooded by a heavy tide, or a river finding itself overly full. That's the second stage. In the third stage, the sea was mostly gone. It had retreated a long way and Boxgrove was a grassy plain out in front of the cliffs. There was a spring at the site giving clear water, filtered by the chalk cliffs. was during that period Boxgrove Man walked with the grass between his toes, a stone hand axe in his hand, and hunting on his mind. The sun shone. It was quite warm beneath its rays. A small group of people walked down a river valley. They carry wooden spears hardened by fire. As they walk on the grassy banks, they talk quietly amongst themselves, reminding each other of the plan. They can smell the distant sea as they walk down the valley. The path is steep, and the river gurgles and bubbles. The wind blows towards them. All of this is good. Where the valley ends, it becomes a grassy plain, and there are animals there. And they know these people bring death. The river's burble hides the sound of them approaching. The sea breeze hides their scent. The plain is rich in beasts, mammoths, woolly rhinos, giant deer and cows. All have been drawn to this place by the rich grasslands where the grazing is good. The humans move out from the gap in the cliffs and split in two. One group stays near the river, hiding in a patch of tall grass and young trees. The other group moves out and around in a wide circle. Some of the animals watch them, nervous, aware, but the group leaves enough room. The animals do a little more than watch and continue eating. There's a large herd of horses. It's why the people have come here. This same herd passed the camp yesterday evening. It was decided that it was time to hunt. The men and women in the grass crouch on their haunches, their fingers flex on the spears. It's quiet. Screaming erupts as the other group bursts forwards towards the herd of horses. They yell, throw spears and chase the beasts. The herd bolts in a flurry of neighs and heavy hooves on the grass. The group crouching pause for a second more. A collected deep breath and they burst from their hiding place. They're in the midst of the panic. Spears are flying past them, horses barrel past. One of their number gets too close and is run down. No one notices. They are hurling their spears into the herd, shouting. A couple of horses fall. They're left by the other horses who thunder up the valley and out of danger. It's over. Quick. Brutal. The sound of hammering hooves fades away. The birds settle back down and return to their chirping. The previous quiet returns, save for wounded horses neighing in pain. A human walks towards them. In his hand is an axe. Two quick blows, and the neighing stops. Other humans walk towards the man who fell. He'd been dragged beneath dozens of hooves. He's silent. Dead. His body battered and crumpled. They close his eyes. There's no time for anything more. The other animals look on perplexed. The deer had ran to a safe distance, and the bull mammoth isn't worried. He keeps pushing bundles of soft, thick grass into his maw with his trunk. The woolly rhinos are also unconcerned. A few of the reunified group heads towards the cliffs, where boulders of chalk and flint are littered. The flint glints like black eyes amongst the chalk. The nodules are heavy, but they heave them away from the cliff. The friends are gathered around the slaughtered horses. There's other predators skulking about, but they don't go too near to the horses whilst the humans are around. They know the human spears mean death. Soon the air is filled with the chip-chipping, tap-knocking of stone on stone as hand axes are made. Practiced hands quickly chip at the large nodules of flint. First they use stones, and then bone and antlers, to create tools to be used. Even though they've done this thousands of times, the occasional mistake is made. The hand axe tips are fragile and easily broken, and the occasional curse is heard as the tip breaks off and the crafter has to reshape the axe to make it suitable. When made, the hand axes are thrown to friends who set to work. They use the cast-off flakes to scrape at the skin, the hand axes to chop through bones and joints. The heavy, wicked-sharp tools make short work of the carcass, and soon the meat is being scraped off the bones, which are then smashed apart, and the rich, thick, soft white marrow within is removed. Some of it is snaffled by the hunters, their reward for their success. When the hand axes become dull, they're ditched, thrown to the earth. Eventually, the humans are done. Where there have been horses, there are now piles of meat and mounds of marrow to carry back. It'll be a tough return to the camp, but it'll be worth it, and easier than dragging up the entire horse carcass. They leave, and all that remains are the scatter of flint flakes, the blunted hand axes, the carcasses of their prey, and their friend who gave his life so that they could feast. Onto the remnants, the scavengers descend. Did you enjoy that? Of course, what you've just heard is entirely fiction. I've brought quite a lot of the evidence together, often from quite different periods. However, Boxgrove is such a complicated site, with such a depth of evidence, that merely presenting the evidence would have resulted in a long and dull recital of information. In addition to this narrative, I wanted to give a shout out to the science. Most archaeology that takes place isn't the muddy-fingered, grubbing-in-the-earth kind that is often presented on television. Obviously, that is vital, but the best of modern archaeology is done by people in white coats in pristine labs. They're using cutting-edge approaches to biology and chemistry to recreate the past. At Boxgrove, the scientific archaeology taught us three particularly awesome things. The man who was trampled by the horses was inspired by a single tibia found during the grassy period of Boxgrove. That's Boxgrove Man. There's no evidence he was trampled to death, but, you know, I thought he made a good tale. Boxgrove Man is the only fossil of Homo heidelbergensis found in Northern Europe not to be a skull. We also have some teeth from Boxgrove, also belonging to Homo heidelbergensis, but probably from another individual. What the archaeologists were able to learn from a single leg bone and a couple of teeth was incredible. We discovered that his body shape was similar to that of the Inuit, being around 6 foot tall and weighing 14 stone. He was built like this to improve his ability to survive the cold, but it also made him a better hunter. Boxgrove Man was 40 when he died. We know he was eaten afterwards, probably by animals, but maybe also by other humans. He would have also used his teeth as a third hand. When Homo heidelbergensis was butchering animals, they probably held strips of meat or skin in their teeth and then cut them from there. We know that because there were cut marks made by flint tools on the teeth found nearby. That's how we also know he was right-handed, because of the direction of the cuts. I've got to say, I'm assuming that Boxgrove Man was a man. We don't know if Boxgrove Man was male or female. Archaeologists have also been able, with a lot of work and I'm assuming a huge amount of frustration, to fit some of the flint flakes together, like a jigsaw 500,000 years in the making. Doing this has increased our understanding of this period by a lot. First of all, we've been able to compare the flakes that were removed with the hand axes we have discovered, to work out the processes that went into creating the tools. This means experimental archaeologists have been able to attempt to recreate hand axes in a way that mimics what we found at Boxgrove. We also have a great understanding of why these hand axes were made. Sometimes the hand axes were abandoned, but sometimes they were used. Of course, some were made at the butchery site to provide quick tools to be used to butcher the animals. These hand axes are excellent tools, really good at chopping, slicing, and crushing, which matches the methodologies of butcheries that we've seen at Boxgrove. However, quite often the hand axes haven't been used. This suggests that humans may have been showing off how quick they can make a hand axe, or how well they can make a hand axe. Well-made hand axes might have been used to reinforce social position, or they may have been left, potentially for social or ritual purposes. Some hand axes were made purely to get flint flakes for use during butchery. Often we find flakes of flint away from the brothers and closest to the butchered animals. This suggests that humans were deliberately creating usable byproducts to complete specific jobs. These flakes are often called end scrapers because it is believed they were used to scrape materials, whether that was meat, skin or plant material. Bosgrove was excavated in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The timing of the excavation meant that some of the really, really clever dating methodologies that we have today weren't available back then. Since Bosgrove is 500,000 years old, radiocarbon dating wouldn't work. A different methodology was required, and the excavators of Bosgrove used a unique methodology, the Volclock. And I'll be honest with you, the Volclock is the reason why I chose to talk about Bosgrove in this episode. A vole is a mouse-like animal, a rodent that can live almost anywhere. That means we find the remains very, very often. Also, because voles give birth up to 10 times a year, they are highly adaptable and can evolve really quickly. During the Pleistocene, the world changed a lot. It swung between being warmer than today and the globe being half encased in ice. This meant there were many selective pressures on animals, forcing the adaptable ones to evolve. Voles evolved a lot. That rapid evolution, combined with their sheer abundance, means we have a very detailed understanding of their evolution and when certain species appeared and died out. This gives us, for want of a better word, a vole clock. Like most sites of this period, we found vole teeth near the remains of Bosgrove Mam and other parts of the site. The vole teeth tell us which vole species we have, and by comparing that species to our vole clock, we can discover the age of the soil context we are digging in. It is reasonable and well supported to assume other finds in the same soil context were deposited at the same time as the voles, and are therefore the same age. That is what tells us that Bosgrove is a site about 500,000 years old. Without the committed, detailed and obsessive approach taken by the scientists who processed the finds from Bosgrove, much of what we have found would be nothing but a pile of bones and stones, foundations for little but conjecture. Science makes us able to understand more about the finds we're looking at, and thus able to create more plausible, detailed stories. Their hard work allows us to think more deeply and complexly about what it means to be human, which is, after all, the purpose of history and archaeology. Because of their work, I've got enough confidence to be able to reconstruct a potential scenario of a successful hunt with a tragedy at its heart. Without their work, then the stories I can tell are limited and unsatisfying things. What have we learned in this episode? As I've researched and written this podcast, the fundamental thing that has struck me again and again is how familiar these early humans were. In a way, their simpler mode of living makes it easier for us to discuss what it means to be human. In these more primitive humans, there is none of the complications that come when discussing modern humans. There's less ritualization, less self-expression, less consciousness. It's hard to talk about modern-day humans at a general level because every one of us is so aware of our own individuality. But we don't see that individualism in the really, really ancient humans. It doesn't mean that it didn't exist. However, since there is almost no evidence of individuals, we can focus on a more critical question. What does it mean to be human? 30 minutes on ancient bones and older stones does not constitute the final word on humanity's meaning and raison d'etre. Of course not. However, indulge me so that I may use what we have learned today to propose a potential answer. Homo heidelbergensis hunted, cooked, lived, travelled and created as a group. Everything we see them doing seems to be together. We find people making hand axes whilst their friends butcher meat. It's implied by the site distribution that they travel to base camps. Here's where the large group would stay. And then smaller groups would travel to resource areas like hunting grounds. The image that comes across is of a tight-knit group, probably an extended family, moving, working, and living together to carve out a niche for themselves at the very edge of the world. This leads me to one conclusion about what it means to be human. There is much satisfaction to be had in the simple things. Being human isn't an endless climb up the hierarchy of needs. It's not about the art we make or the money we have. It's not about being remembered. Being human is about being in a community. At the core of the human approach to survival, the reason we exist are other humans. Yes, they infuriate us, but man was not made to be alone. Life is about living, eating, and working together. If you've got an opinion on this, let me know. You can reach me at oldbonespodcast@gmail.com. There's also a Facebook page, an Instagram, and a Patreon. Links are in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It will really, really help. Thanks in advance. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. See you soon.